Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, June 26, 2017. It's the week of the end of the term of the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is when they drop all of the stinky turds that they've been saving up over the last 6 months. And the surprise to me was the unanimous decision upholding most of the key elements of Trump's royal decree, the travel ban 2.0. Unanimous? Ignoring the work of the lower courts, the appeals court in Richmond and the one here in San Francisco, that advanced strong arguments about why the Trump travel bans constituted an overreach based on insufficient evidence? Well, it was an unsigned opinion, and these are the most maddening actions of the Supreme Court, because they publish this crap and they don't explain it. They just leave it to us to chew on it and try to figure it out. And what is odd here is that the court has intervened in a way that does appear to be appropriate, you know, in terms of policy and process. But they designated the case for hearings this fall, noting or hoping that the whole issue will have expired. It will be moot by that time. And the court can cavalierly just leave this to the dustbin of history. But it leaves us with an incoherent, irrational arrangement regarding immigration, driven by fear of Muslims, by, you know, these decisions based on broad categories of people, not troubling behavior of individuals that might prevent them from being allowed to travel into the United States. And so I'm scratching my head about this one. And it has caught me by surprise. It appeared to me the court was going to duck this issue and just let it play out and let it go away. And so what the justices did do was draw some limitations. They imposed one exception. The ban may not be enforced against foreign nationals who have a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. This is being interpreted to mean that if you have a close family member who supports a visa application, or if you are a student who has a reasonable, you've been accepted at a university here, or if you're a job applicant. These apparently are acceptable to the Supreme Court as the only reasons to go around Trump's six-nation ban. And I just find it irrational and incoherent. I don't know what they are trying to tell us. Some analysis of this 9-0 decision from Matt Zapatosky at the Washington Post. The court has effectively allowed Trump to ban from coming to the United States only citizens of six majority Muslim countries who lack any bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. I'll continue quoting here. It also nudged the president to complete his promised review of vetting procedures, which might mean the issue is resolved by the time the court is set to fully consider the ban in its October term, as I mentioned. So, I really don't understand this, because the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond used Trump's tweets, the racism and anti-Muslim sentiment venom that he expressed in the campaign last year. And the court, to my knowledge, has not commented on that. The appeal that came out of the Ninth Circuit Court here, that has this reputation for being excessively liberal, it didn't focus on Trump's comments or racism. It talked about the fact that this is a hysterical overreaction, and banning people from all of these countries, essentially all people from all of these countries, is irrational. And from the news account so far, I'm not seeing that the court took any of that very seriously, or even considered it in this unsigned opinion that was released today. And here's an example from Saturday's New York Times. A Syrian dissident, longtime opponent of the Assad regime, as Washington loves to call it, he is the 41-year-old Radwan Ziadeh, spelled Z-I-A-D-E-H. He lives in suburban Washington. He has been a research fellow, or a fellow at Harvard, Georgetown, the United States Institute of Peace, and he is a longtime opponent of Bashar al-Assad, who convened a peace conference in Istanbul from November 2012 to May of 2013. And because he included groups that have been supported by the United States, both rhetorically and militarily and economically, oh, that's three, Peter, not just two, he has been told that his request for political asylum is being turned down. He got a 12-page letter with the description of intention to deny, claiming that he had provided material support because he held a peace conference. I can only say these are bizarre times, friends. The best news out of the Supreme Court is that none of the octogenarian justices retired, including Ginsburg and Anthony Kennedy. So the beat goes on with the court as we have it. These spate of announcements and decisions revealed today do tell us a lot about the new guy Gorsuch. Oh, he's a Bible thumper. He's a gun lover. And some of these, I'm surprised that he's permitted to participate. For example, this ruling on the Missouri law, it was a court ruling from Missouri, that said that church groups could not receive funding to repair their playgrounds. Now, a lot of people look at this and they say, well, a playground, you know, that doesn't have any religious purpose. But I am a staunch advocate of separation of church and state. And this 7-2 ruling said that it violates the protection of the free exercise of religion to exclude churches from state programs to fund improvements to playgrounds? I'm sorry. I don't believe, I mean, my view is my view, but I don't think that swing sets and sandboxes should be subsidized when they are present on church property. Because the money that the church receives to repair its playground from the state frees up other money that would have been used to repair the playground so that they can, proselytize, promote their religious views. And they're free to do that, but not with my taxpayer money. And the dissent came from Justice Sotomayor, who summarized it when the decision was announced. She said the ruling weakens this country's longstanding commitment to a separation of church and state, beneficial to both. If this separation means anything, it means that the government cannot, or at the very least need not, tax its citizens and turn that money over to houses of worship. The court today blinds itself to the outcome this history requires and leads us instead to a place where separation of church and state is a constitutional slogan, not a constitutional commitment. Nice job, Sonia, but where were you on the travel ban? I don't get it. And I do understand the history and the law that the president does have wide deference when it comes to immigration protocols and policies. But not based on discriminatory intent, not based on hysterical misrepresentations of the threat that is posed by people entering our country. Next up, the court declined to hear a case from California, leaving the lower court decision standing. And that decision upheld a California law that places pretty strict limits on carrying guns in public, particularly concealed carry. And here's where we find out more about the new guy, Neil Gorsuch. He joined Clarence Thomas in dissenting. As Thomas wrote, this reflects a distressing trend, the treatment of the Second Amendment as a disfavored right. The case, Peruta versus California, concerned a state law that essentially bans carrying guns openly in public and allows carrying concealed weapons only if applicants can demonstrate good cause. The challengers, individuals and gun rights groups, sued in San Diego and in the north part of the state, Yolo County, saying that officials there interpreted good cause so narrowly as to make it impossible to carry guns in public for self-defense. And the dangerous rogue Ninth Circuit in a 7-4 ruling had said there was no Second Amendment right to carry a concealed weapon. And I agree with that. So the court did something right today. The Congressional Budget Office has scored the latest version of scuttling Obamacare that is under consideration, may get a vote this week in the United States Senate. You may recall the House version was scored as leading to 23 million people losing health insurance over the next 10 years. The Senate bill is much better. 22 million people will be kicked off the health insurance rolls. 15 million in the first year alone. And the Senate bill is different in that it almost doubles the amount of deficit reduction at the expense of people who die because they don't have health care. Senate leaders today have amended their bill to penalize people who go without health insurance by requiring them to wait 6 months before their coverage would begin. And if you get cancer or meningitis or any number of serious illnesses, you could be on your deathbed or maybe in the ground by the time that six-month waiting period expires. This is the Republican death panel, the death panel that Sarah Palin predicted would come from Obamacare, but instead is really being enacted in the process of dismantling Obamacare. And it is a little confusing because on the one hand, we have Senator Dean Heller of Nevada, Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who are saying they can't vote for this because of the steep cuts to Medicaid that will affect the residents of their states. And then we've got the real knuckle-draggers, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, Johnson from Wisconsin, and I'm leaving somebody out. Anyway, they want it to be meaner. They want a complete repeal of Obamacare. They want to dismantle it entirely. They don't care how many people get sick, how many people suffer, how many people die. And even the Koch brothers, who want Obamacare dismantled, held their super-secret conference in, Breckenridge, Colorado this weekend. They had a super-secret meeting with Vice President Pence. It's secret because we all know about it now. And the Koch brothers support the full repeal. They're libertarians, and they don't care if people die. But they are concerned about the political blowback. And they've decided to commit only $400 million to rich people buying elections in 2018. And they're still walking a fine line because they weren't big supporters of Trump. But gosh, as long as he's doing things they like, particularly when it comes to the oil patch, they'll take it. They will take it. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. I got a cool note and an extra $20 from subscriber Craig Daniels in North Bend, Oregon, via the P.O. box over the weekend. Thank you, Craig. I really appreciate that. And also, you know, I just print out a list of the recent payments at PayPal, and I don't have any control over the order of it. But Terry Paris has become my sugar mama. She appears to have one of every type of subscription to the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And today alone, I see her payment of a $5 monthly subscription, a day before, a payment of a $10 monthly subscription. I know she just took out a recent $50 annual subscription. So, Terry, thank you for your generosity. Let's also mention Tom Burkhardt, who renewed his annual subscription, and Cheryl Fleming, a staunch monthly subscriber here at the PBC podcast. I'd like you to join their ranks. I don't mention it when people cancel their subscriptions, but they do. And right now, there have been more cancellations than signups in the last few weeks. So can you help me cover the gap? Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on menu, pull it down, click on become a subscriber. You end up on the sign-up page where the bonus books are displayed. And I want to send out some copies of Tom Frank's Listen Liberal. All you got to do is give me a mailing address in the U.S. and take out a new annual subscription. I've got them right over there on the shelf, ready to ship out to you. So, the whole Trump-Russia thing is descending into cacophony. On Friday, we talked to you about the 37-page blockbuster piece in the Washington Post that detailed what Obama knew, when he knew it, how he knew it. As I said, it read like a spy novel in many respects, or a screenplay for a spy thriller movie. But it didn't have any new evidence. It had a narrative that's more detailed than the one we've seen before. And in it, the takeaway from the left is that Obama didn't do enough to expose the perfidy of Russia in manipulating our election. And the attack from the right, including an incoherent one from Trump, is that, oh, it's all Obama's fault. Why didn't he stop this? Now, Trump has himself in a real pickle, and my question is, will the truth corner him? He is such a slippery son of a bitch, and he lies so blatantly. Maybe you saw it in print in the Sunday New York Times. They filled the back page of the Week in Review with the list of lies that he has uttered since he took office. Can we corner him with the truth? Well, we don't know the truth. That is the problem here. And so, as Greg Sargent points out in the Washington Post today, Trump has put himself in a fiendishly clever new position. He will fully acknowledge that Russia did try to sabotage our election, but only in the context of blaming Barack Obama for it. In his latest tweets, he essentially acknowledges that the intelligence community, in fact, correctly concluded that Russia interfered with the purpose of helping Trump win. Now, I don't have enough evidence to support that conclusion, but that's what a lot of people believe inside the Beltway. And so this now becomes, we just descend into these siloed arguments. And I've heard Limbaugh and Hannity working this over in recent days. Oh, the collusion thing's all gone. There's nothing to it. But look at what Obama failed to do. And again, for Democrats who have been stoking this whole Trump-Russia thing as a conscious political messaging campaign, they're kind of out there over a cliff. And again, the Washington Post piece from Friday offers new details but no evidence. And we may be in this evidence-free environment for a long time, and then it becomes, well, which narrative prevails? Neither one proven. Each one stoutly believed by its partisan supporters. And back to this piece by Sargent, in the Post. He says, due either to his megalomania or his dishonesty or some combination of the two, Trump has regularly conflated two questions. First, the question of what Russia did to undermine the election. And second, whether the Trump campaign colluded with those efforts. Trump has regularly dismissed the latter question, of course, but this has had the effect of leading him to be unwilling to seriously grapple with the former, which, of course, he calls a big dem hoax. But now Trump is fully acknowledging that this meddling did happen, provided he can blame Obama for it. More to the point, though, his tweets this morning admit that our intelligence community did not only conclude this, but also that Russia did this to help him win the election. So, It really is quite bizarre. And we are untethered, and I know that many of my listeners are frustrated. They think somehow the Oracle of Marin County here should be able to figure it all out and just tell you. But there's so much bullshit flying. We can smell it. We can feel it. But it's not evidence, and it doesn't prove much. Jason Leopold got another FOIA victory. He got the release of a letter that was written by Dianne Feinstein and Maryland Senator Ben Cardin on November 1st last year, exactly 1 week before Election Day, demanding that President Obama take action immediately against Russia for state-sponsored cyber attacks on the U.S. and its democratic institutions. Quote, such attacks cannot be tolerated. The U.S. must take immediate measures to ensure that those responsible are held to account. Now, one of the theories I've heard about this alleged inaction by Obama, and we know that he confronted Putin and he called him up and told him, stop this shit. But why didn't he go public after the election and say this was grand larceny, grand theft, not auto, grand theft democracy? They didn't challenge the results. They didn't participate in the recount. You may have heard me say this before, and maybe you're tired of it. They didn't challenge it at the Electoral College when there were electors who were eager to do so, and they didn't challenge it in the final certification in the Senate during the first week of January. In each case, even if they hadn't been successful, they could have sent a clear message of rejection of the credibility and the legitimacy of Trump assuming the presidency. But they didn't do that. And that's the biggest question for me about all of this stuff that has come out recently. Again, it adds detail to the narrative, but it doesn't prove what we were told happened. Norman Solomon, my buddy here from the Left Coast, has penned an op-ed that's available today at Consortium News. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast. Headline reads, Democrats Face Failing Russiagate Scheme. Let me read his opener. The plan for Democrats to run against Russia may be falling apart. After squandering much of the last 6 months on faulting Russians for the horrific presidency of Donald Trump, after blaming America's dire shortfalls of democracy on plutocrats in Russia more than on plutocrats in America, after largely marketing the brand of their own party as a more anti-Russian than pro-working people, after stampeding many Democratic Party-aligned organizations, pundits, and activists into fixating more on Russia than on the 1,000 chronic cuts to democracy here at home, after soaking up countless hours of TV airtime and vast quantities of ink and zillions of pixels to denounce Russia in place of offering progressive remedies to the deep economic worries of American voters, now Democrats in Congress and other party leaders are starting to face an emerging reality. The, quote, winning issue of Russia is a losing issue. And Solomon notes that the Hill reported over the weekend that many Democrats are telling party leaders, stop talking about Russia. In sharp contrast to the top spokespeople, rank-and-file Democrats say the Russia-Trump narrative is simply a non-issue with district voters. And Solomon cites a new poll. 58% of voters say they're concerned that Trump may have business dealings with Moscow, but 73% say they're worried that the ongoing investigations are preventing Congress from tackling issues more vital to them. Now, that assumes that Congress would tackle issues vital to us instead of just, you know, giving tax cuts to the rich and cutting health care to the rest of us. And the poll was conducted by former Hillary Clinton advisor Mark Penn. He ran the 2008 campaign. Great job, Mark. His comment, while the voters have a keen interest in any Russian election interference, they are concerned that the investigations have become a distraction for the president and Congress that is hurting rather than helping the country. CNN got bitten. Had to retract a story that they published on their website last Thursday that cited a single unnamed source who claimed that the Senate Intelligence Committee was looking into a $10 billion Russian investment fund whose chief executive met with a member of Donald Trump's transition team 4 days before the inauguration. New rules have been issued at CNN. There are two people now who have to approve any printed articles or video reports that deal with Russia. Well, Seymour Hersh is now encountering a massive blackout of his work from U.S. media and media in the United Kingdom. His last few reports couldn't find an outlet in the United States, and so he turned to the London Review of Books. They turned him down on his most recent report, which was published in the German publication called Die Welt. And it went public on Sunday, and I'm linking to an article that reviews Hersh's report, written by former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, a man I have deep respect for. And he breaks down Hersh's report, which is sharply critical of the media accounts and the propaganda from the Trump administration regarding the April 4th incident in Khan Shukun, Syria. The alleged sarin release. Now, I need to be fair. I try to be. Seymour Hersh has built his reputation on inside sources in the Pentagon and the intelligence community. His article, like so many others, is based on anonymous sources. And I leave it to you to decide whether you believe the anonymous sources cited by Seymour Hersh more than the anonymous sources that are cited by Rachel Maddow, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. And when he breaks down the sequence of events on April 4th, it is reported by Hersh that the Syrians and Russians contacted the United States on the deconfliction line and said, yes, we're going to attack Khan Shukun. They disclosed that they were going to attack a building where they believed a meeting of rebel leaders was taking place. And Cy Hersh reports, consistent with the claims of Syria and Russia, that that building had munitions in the basement. And Russia gave the Syrian Air Force a GPS-guided bomb that was used for this attack. And they are telling us that the simple explanation, which has been rejected by the United States, despite the lack of physical evidence and timelines from the ground there, the lack of any independent on-the-ground investigation. Well, Hersh's analysis, I think, is another serious blow to the credibility of the U.S. media and the way that they backed Trump. Now, I referenced earlier how the New York Times published a list of all Trump's lies, and they called them lies. Aren't they courageous? But the New York Times bought into the lies about the Syrian government's use of sarin in Khan Shukun. We know that this caused an about-face from Trump, who had announced to three different outlets that he was dialing back the demand that the Assad government go. 3 days later, what largely appears to be a concoction, a false flag event, blamed on the Syrians and the Russians, suddenly occurs. And Ray McGovern, underscoring what I said a moment ago, he said, what is interesting about the Khan Shukun case is that this was a test of whom the mainstream media detested more. The MSM has taken the position that pretty much whatever Trump says is untrue, or at least deserving of intense fact-checking. But the MSM also believes whatever attacks on Assad that the Syrian activists post on social media are true and disbelieves whatever Putin says. So this was a tug of war on which prejudices were stronger, and it turned out that the antipathy toward Syria and Russia is more powerful than the distrust of Trump. Well said, Ray. Over at consortiumnews.com, where Ray McGovern's item is posted, is also a strong commentary from Joe Lauria. He is an expert on the Middle East. He's currently living in Iraq, and he was a guest on our program recently to talk about his annotation of Hillary Clinton's comments in a book called Why I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Well, his latest analysis regards this split that Trump has taken sides on between Saudi Arabia and its allies on the Gulf Cooperation Council against fellow GCC member Qatar. The demand is that Qatar has to shut down Al Jazeera and stop funding terrorists in Syria. Well, the Saudis do as much, if not more, than the Qataris of funding proxy elements in Syria. And so for Trump to get sucked into this is one that raises a lot of questions. Well, what Joe Lauria outlines is the possible scenario that Trump may support a Saudi invasion and takeover of Qatar. Qatar has strong economic alliances with Iran. They share a big gas field, natural gas. And if Qatar goes away and becomes a wholly owned subsidiary of the Saudis, then the scenario outlined by Joe Lauria is that would pave the way for a U.S.-led assault on Iran. Now, this is speculation. I want to be very clear about that. But Joe Lauria is a well-informed veteran of the Middle East. He's covered it for a long time. He was also at the United Nations for many years. Take a look at it and consider what he outlines. And this also is good background for today's New York Times report about the odd man out in the Trump administration when it comes to this issue of Qatar versus Saudi Arabia, and that's Rexon Tillerson, who's still trying to play Secretary of State, and he wanted to play the mediator in this dispute. But then Trump tweeted and spoke up at a news conference. He's called Qatar a funder of terrorism at a very high level. Check the Saudis, Donnie. Check the Saudis. And so it appears that the Crown Prince Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon hold more sway over Trump on these issues than Rexon Tillerson, who knows all of these guys from his days at ExxonMobil. I believe we were sold on him as the Secretary of State because of those relationships and his international savvy. And Tillerson is also at odds with Republicans on the Hill. Bob Corker ridicules the proposal by Tillerson for a 30% cut in the State Department's budget, saying that he wouldn't even review the proposal. It would be a waste of time. And the State Department is so understaffed that when foreign counterparts contact the State Department, they don't get a return call. And so some of them have been directly contacting the National Security Council at the White House. The disarray appears to be intentional, to permit the freelancing of Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon, because there is no staff at Foggy Bottom to drive the Secretary of State. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment podcast today. It's available on YouTube and everywhere you find it. It's free. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.